From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Police arrested 127 people overnight in Louisville, Kentucky, as protests raged over yesterday's grand jury decision not to charge three officers for the death of Breonna Taylor.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Justice! Two Louisville police officers were shot during last night's protest. They are expected to recover. A suspect is in custody.
In the case of the officers involved in Breonna Taylor's death, only one of those officers, who served a warrant on March 13th at Taylor's apartment, was indicted for putting neighbors in harm's way when he fired into Taylor's apartment. But protesters taking to the streets in some cities around the country, along with Taylor's family, are outraged that no officer will face charges directly related to her death. And for the latest, we have Ryan Van Velzer from WFPL in Louisville. And Ryan, give us a sense of what it was like there today, of what it's like there today and what it was like last night. One observer said what struck her the most at the protests yesterday were the sobs. She couldn't even remember seeing so many protesters crying. What did you see?
In some ways, it felt like the first days of the protests all over again. You know, these protests, they carry the whole spectrum of human emotion, and it's hard to wrap up in a bow. You can actually feel that emotion as it moves through the crowd at times. And yesterday I saw people marching through the street who were motivated to seek change. There was still hope and they had a lot of determination. On social media, you know, I saw people rallying not just in Kentucky but around the countries, and I talked to protesters about that and they found that encouraging. But from the moment the decision came down, I also saw tears, grief, frustration, and I guess what I would call despair. Some people lit fires in the downtown square at the heart of the protests. That's really the first time I'd seen that in that place, although I guess there were some small fires the first days of protests as well. Police declared an unlawful assembly in response, and that was an hour or so before the curfew started. And through it all, one thing that surprised me was actually this Breonna Taylor Memorial, which is kind of the symbolic heart of the protests here. It remained unscathed through it all.
You actually spoke with many of the protesters. What did they share with you?
Yeah, actually, let me share a clip with you. Here's protester Rakila Jones talking with me shortly after the news came out.
It's not right. Y'all shouldn't be able to just bypass all the crimes that y'all do just because y'all a cop. Like, it doesn't make it right for y'all to murder somebody and to be able to be walking around kids, have another job if you get fired from another job to another state. That don't make no sense to me. Like, I believe that y'all should be banned from being a cop at all.
What about police? How did they interact with protesters, and what have they been saying since this announcement came yesterday?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, 127 people were arrested last night. I think that's a record since protests have started here, and that puts total arrests well over 700 since, you know, this all started on May 28th. And late last night, yesterday morning, I should say that the mayor and the police chief, they welcomed protesters downtown in a press conference. But that's even, you know, as the National Guard was called in, the FBI, the ATF, Federal Protective Services, as well as a slew of local and state law enforcement as well. And protesters were met with barricades around downtown, aggressive police tactics throughout the city. Police were more hesitant to fire tear gas than they were in the early days of the protests. But they pushed people around. They kettled protesters, fired flashbangs, pepper balls, and foam marker rounds. I'm actually holding a 40-millimeter shell casing in my hand right now, left over from last night.
Oh, wow. What can you tell us about the two police officers who were shot? We know that both are expected to recover, and one person has been taken into custody. Is there anything else that you can tell us?
There was a press conference just an hour ago at 11 o'clock. Interim Police Chief Robert Schroeder says both officers are doing well and are expected to survive their injuries. One of the officers injured was a leader overseeing much of the law enforcement response to protests. His name was Major Aubrey Gregory, and he was hit in the thigh. The other officer is named Robinson DeRouche. We don't know that much about the suspected shooter at this point. Police arrested Lorenzo Johnson last night. We don't know if he was a protester. He is facing two charges of assault against a police officer and 14 charges of wanton endangerment.
With the 30 seconds I have with you, the FBI is continuing its investigation of potential violations of federal law in this case. What can you tell us? What's the latest there?
Yeah, so The FBI is investigating the potential civil rights violations linked to the process and policies that led to the raid at Taylor's apartment. And that's important because a lot of questions have been raised about that process, how the search warrant was obtained, how the judge signed off on it, and why they chose Taylor's house in the first place. But that FBI investigation is still ongoing, and there's not a lot of information out about it yet. And the results, of course, are not yet public.
That's Ryan Van Velzer from WFPL in Louisville. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, to politics, the Senate will likely soon take up the nomination of the next Supreme Court justice. One of the many Republicans backing the president's push for that vote is West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito, who's running for re-election against Democratic activist Paula Jean Swearengin. Let's take a look at that race for this week's Here and Now Senate Tracker. Dave Mistich is senior reporter at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. He's in Morgantown. Dave, first, what's the state of this race?
Well, you know, West Virginia has become a Republican stronghold in recent years. Capito first won the Senate seat in 2014. And since then, both on the state level and the federal races have sort of swung Republican, which is interesting because the state for decades and decades, 80 some years, had been a Democratic stronghold. You know, looking ahead to this race, I think, you know, it's clear to say that Capito would be considered a favorite, given that the political climate here. She's also outraised Paula Jean Swearengin by, you know, $3 plus million for this race. So It's safe to say that things are looking her direction right now.
Except this year, you never know about anything. So we'll take a deep look at both and start with Senator Moore Capito, who spoke with one of your colleagues this month about the president's handling of the pandemic. Let's listen.
If I had it to do over again for him, I would have been much more concise, clear, to the American people of what the dangers are, how you can be effective in fighting the dangers, and be very honest with where we are at any given time.
So, Dave, a little bit critical of President Trump there. What is she running on?
Capito is running on her record. She votes with her party 98.3% of the time. That's according to ProPublica's Represent. Obviously, you know, she's tied herself to Trump, as have most Republicans here in the state. She's running, you know, on her experience and obviously right of center to West Virginians here.
And we heard some criticism there. You say she's aligning herself with the president. What about filling the vacancy? I mean, she's in line.
Right. So back in 2016, given the President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland, Senator Capito actually, you know, argued that before the Supreme Court justice was confirmed to a lifetime position, that West Virginians and the American people should have the ability to weigh in at the ballot box. She basically did a 180 on that position following the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg last week, and basically said that President Trump and the Republican Senate were both elected by the American people and that they should be able to act to fill this Supreme Court vacancy. So a very different position, and Paula Jean Swearengin has been taking aim at that. What Paula Jean calls as hypocrisy.
We should say that kind of flip-flop hasn't seemed to bother the Republican base at all. But the Democratic challenger, Paula Jean Swearengin, comes from a family of coal miners. And here she lays out some of her campaign promises in this ad.
We will have Medicare for all. We won't back down until our workers are protected. Our public schools will be fully funded and supported. It is time to have a campaign for U.S. Senate in West Virginia ran by the people.
So Medicare for all. Was it a surprise that someone promising this, which is controversial within the Democratic Party, it's to the left of Joe Biden, won the Democratic primary in West Virginia?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, obviously West Virginians rely very heavily on health care, you know, from the government, have a high percentage of people that are on Medicaid here. In 2016, Bernie Sanders did really well in the primary, and Paula Jean has sort of attached herself to that wing of the Democratic Party. This is not Paula Jean's first run at the Senate. She made a primary run in 2018 against Joe Manchin, in which he put up more than 30% of the vote, which, given the fact that Manchin's such a popular figure here, is pretty respectable. Also should point out that, you know, in this year's primary, she beat Richard Ojeda, who was a sort of a galvanizing figure in the teacher strikes that happened over the past 2 years here. And so, you know, despite the state swinging Republican, that there is sort of an undercurrent of progressives. And I think Paula Jean's performance in primaries over the past couple of years in races for Senate clearly shows that that's the case.
Well, I'm wondering, too, just, you know, briefly, if there's an embrace of a coal miner's daughter, you know, in West Virginia.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, there's some element of that, you know, as we point out, as a lot of reporters point out, that the stronghold of that industry on the state has sort of waned away. So yeah. I think what Paula Jean's sort of getting at is sort of an environmentalist stance, you know, looking for clean air, clean water, health care. So she's sort of acknowledging that the coal industry has had a significant influence on this place, but that maybe that influence is waning significantly.
Well, and also was harmful to health. Dave Mistich, senior reporter at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump has recently been calling for patriotic education in public schools. Here he is this week at a rally in Pittsburgh.
We will teach our children to love our country, honor our history, and always respect our great American flag.
He wants to create a 1776 commission to promote patriotic education, and he singled out the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning 1619 Project, calling the teaching of it in public schools a form of child abuse because it seeks to reframe American history by centering it on the consequences of slavery. Andrew Ujifusa is a reporter for Education Week and joins us with more on this. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So President Trump threatened to pull funding from schools that use the 1619 Project in class. Can he actually do that? And is it consistent with his past views on who controls what schools teach?
So the short answer is no. In fact, if you look at federal law governing public schools, the federal government is barred from rewarding or punishing schools for teaching a specific curriculum. And this has had bipartisan support for many years. And in fact, if you go back to 2017, Trump signed an executive order that took a very different tack. It basically underscored this idea that there should not be federal interference in state and local decisions about curriculum. And as a candidate in 2016, he said that Washington bureaucrats should not be involved in dictating what students are taught and how children learn, and said that parents should have control over, you know, what their children learn. So if you go back just a few years and then compare it to what he's said in the last few months about this issue, they don't necessarily mesh very well.
Well, the backdrop of all of this is that there's been a lot of efforts to show a more complete history of America in school curriculums. That's really been over the last 20 to 30 years. Do we actually know how many school systems use the 1619 Project? And if so, what are teachers saying about it?
I don't have a number for how many schools are using a curriculum based on the 1619 Project, but I think it is growing in popularity. I think many teachers find it an interesting and different way to teach about slavery in American history than how it's been taught. I think for a long time, as you indicated, there's been controversy and discomfort about how slavery is taught. For example, it's not uncommon to hear stories about reenactments of slavery in classrooms that can make students of color, for example, feel very uncomfortable. And I think teachers are trying to engage the subject in a new way. And I think some of them appreciate that the 1619 Project is giving them avenues and materials and a platform to do that. Something else that's very longstanding is discomfort with how teachers have taught American history. And among conservatives, I think there's been a sense that teachers have taught it in a way that's too critical of things like the American Revolution and the Founding Fathers. So I think there's tension that goes both ways, and I think Trump is definitely wading into that.
Yeah, the theoretical framework that underpins the 1619 Project is critical race theory. It examines society and culture through the lens of racial inequality. Does it surprise you that it has become such a flashpoint?
It doesn't especially surprise me. I think that one way to look at this is that Trump is trying to use this debate about the 1619 Project for his political advantage, which, you know, shouldn't be shocking to people. In fact, he linked how students learn about American history in many public schools and what he called left-wing indoctrination in schools to protests and unrest this summer over racial justice issues. And he obviously thinks that focusing on those protests is a winning political issue for him in the 2020 election. So it's not especially surprising. As I indicated earlier, it does represent a departure from what he said about the issue in the past. But that was then. This is now.
Yeah, right. And it does go along with his ban on federal training on implicit bias, which is a concept that's central to critical race theory. We talked a bit about, can he actually ban classrooms from using the 1619 Project? But can the president even impose a 1776 curriculum on schools?
No, he cannot, not under current federal law. I should point out that over the summer, Senator Tom Cotton introduced a bill that essentially tracks with Trump's demand to withhold funds from schools that use the 1619 Project for curriculum. Now, that bill hasn't gone anywhere. I believe there's a companion measure, essentially, that's been introduced by House Republicans more recently. So, again, I think Trump is touching on something that can generate a lot of energy in political conservative circles, but it's not something that we should expect in terms of the federal government imposing a curriculum tomorrow or something like that. It's just not something that they're allowed to do. And I should add that last week when Betsy DeVos was speaking about history curriculum at an event marking Constitution Day, she herself said decisions about curriculum are best left to state and local officials. Mm. And I think that's how the vast majority of folks in the field feel about it.
That's Andrew Ujifusa. He's a reporter for Education Week. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
We now turn to the latest news with the Center for Disease Control. In a Senate hearing yesterday, Dr. Robert Redfield once again stated that while 700 million COVID-19 vaccine doses could be ready by March, widespread vaccination won't be possible until spring of 2021.
That's going to take us April, May, June, you know, possibly July to get the entire American public completely vaccinated.
As Americans wait for that COVID-19 vaccine, Dr. Redfield also advised that people take the widely available flu shot right now to avoid straining an already burdened healthcare system this winter. And for more on this, we're joined by Dr. Ram Kapaka, Director of Adult Immunization Services at the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I want to talk with you about the importance of a flu shot this year. But before we get started, I want to ask you about President Trump's statement that he can overrule the Food and Drug Administration if the agency released tougher standards on the authorization of a COVID-19 vaccine. The president wants to have a vaccine ready by November 3rd. The FDA is considering guidelines that could push that date further. As a medical professional, how concerning is this for you?
Well, that's not really my area of expertise. We don't know exactly when the vaccine for COVID-19 will become widely available for the general public. But what we do know is that, as Dr. Redfield mentioned in his testimony yesterday, that we do have a freely available, widely available, effective vaccine against influenza. And it's more important than ever for Americans to focus on getting the flu vaccine, preferably in September and October, before flu viruses begin circulating in our communities. It's an effective means of flattening the curve of respiratory illnesses in our communities. And the more we can do that, the more we can save scarce medical resources that can be directed against the fight against COVID-19.
Do you anticipate that because of COVID-19 and the flu having similar symptoms, that is also a major concern as you think about medical professionals being able to meet the needs of patients as they come in during the thick of the winter months?
Well, every year we recommend that individuals get their flu vaccine before flu viruses circulate widely in our communities. And that is, getting the vaccine is optimal in the September-October timeframe, again, before flu begins to circulate in the communities. It's particularly important this year because by getting the flu vaccine, an individual can prevent the more serious complications of flu illness that might result in requiring hospitalization and thereby reduce the burden on the healthcare system.
Doctor, who is at risk for flu-related complications, and does getting the flu make you more susceptible to COVID-19?
So all individuals are susceptible to contracting influenza. However, as you implied, there are individuals who are particularly high risk of developing complications, the more serious complications from influenza infection. Those include individuals 65 years of age and older, and individuals with chronic underlying conditions such as heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, and so forth. And it also includes very young children. Flu vaccine can help reduce the risk of those complications in those individuals that are at higher risk, but really in all individuals.
Is there any concern about having enough flu vaccinations as more people go to get a flu shot?
This year, we worked with our partners in the manufacturing industry to optimize the amount of flu vaccine that would be available, recognizing that it was important for as many people as possible to get vaccinated this fall. So we anticipate the supply of flu vaccine will be on the order of 194 to 198 million doses for the U.S. market. Again, we want to make sure that as many people as possible get vaccinated against flu optimally in September and October. But if it's November or December and an individual hasn't been vaccinated, it is not too late. The flu season lasts all the way into April and May of the following year.
That was Dr. Ram Kapaka, Director of Adult Immunization Services at the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases.
The Southeastern Conference kicks off its pandemic-shortened football season Saturday, but elsewhere, most teams are postponing games because of COVID-19. That includes Notre Dame, which was supposed to play Wake Forest, but that's been rescheduled because several Notre Dame players tested positive. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, we've seen COVID outbreaks on college campuses, but schools, conferences seem determined to play. Boston College, one of the few in New England, it's getting a lot of scrutiny. The Boston Globe reports BC takes in at least $32 million from football. UConn only takes in $17 million from men's and women's basketball. Is this all about money?
Well, it's certainly about money. And let's, if you're confused about that, there is a designation, the non-revenue sports, things like women's soccer and volleyball and cross country. And guess what? The NCAA postponed all of them to 2021. Mm-hmm. So if they're not making revenue, they're not playing. But it's about more than money also. It's about culture. It's about connection of alumni to school. I mean, college football is like religion in many parts of the country. Mm-hmm. But we should also say that it is a huge risk. And you noted that Notre Dame is, that game is being canceled. Well, so is University of South Florida, because they played Notre Dame last week, and they're actually doing contact tracing via watching the game film to see which defensive players maybe guarded too closely an offensive player on Notre Dame who was afflicted with coronavirus. So this is a sketchy and to many degrees a money-related decision.
I'm thinking of trainers and staff going home to their families, but let's move to pro sports. We're 2 weeks into the NFL season. The Raiders have played their first game in their new home in Las Vegas, which seems like an ultimate marriage of pro sports and gambling. Your thoughts?
Well, maybe it's an ultimate marriage of the acknowledgement that pro sports and gambling have been intertwined for so many years. And yeah, it's official, but it's always been known. And this goes way beyond just the fact that the Raiders are now the Las Vegas Raiders. If you watch the games on Sunday, there will be breaks sometimes when they show the actual game going on in the corner of the screen. And some announcer from one of the sports betting sites will beg you to come on their site and place a wager with them. So it is extremely interwoven. And I guess you could say this is the NFL acknowledging that they get a lot of business from people who are looking to bet on their games. So as long as they make it on the up and up, and they have taken great strides to do so, I don't know that this threatens the integrity of the game. That was the concern years ago. I think it's just an acknowledgement of how people experience football in 2020 and have been doing so for decades before.
And by the way, we need to mention there were protests after news that no police officers will be charged for Breonna Taylor's death. Sports went on a schedule. We've got the NBA playoffs going on. How is this affecting athletes, many of whom have called for social justice?
Right. The director of the NBA union, Michelle Roberts, said, sadly, there was no justice today for Breonna Taylor. Her killing was the result of a string of callous and careless decisions made with a lack of regard for humanity. LeBron James tweeted about being devastated, hurt, and mad. It's not only the athletes talking about the decisions of law enforcement. Law enforcement talked about the athletes. The Attorney General, Daniel Cameron, in his press conference, talked about LeBron James, also mentioned Beyonce, because this has been a cause bigger than sports itself.
We'll take it up again. Mike Pesca here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
As Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg lies in repose at the Supreme Court, we're hearing how mothers are coming with daughters to pay respects, little girls dressed in black with white lacy collars. I'm thinking of my mother, who by law in the 60s couldn't get her own credit card, or me signing a contract in the 70s that said I couldn't get pregnant or otherwise disfigured. How is it no one took this gender discrimination on the way she did? Well, for one thing, there were laws in some parts banning women from being lawyers. For another, she was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jonathan Enten was her legal clerk in the 1980s when she was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit Court. He's now a professor emeritus of law and adjunct professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. He joins us on Skype. And Jonathan, we are just so sorry for your personal loss.
Well, thank you. You know, the clerks were all part of Justice Ginsburg's family, and she was really part of our family. But I think the loss is not personal so much as it is institutional for the court and just for the entire country.
Yeah. We know that many clerks are in Washington, D.C., and there was, over 100 of them lining the steps of the Supreme Court to receive her casket. What did you think when you saw that?
I was just completely blown away. I'm not a sentimental person, but it was really hard to keep things together.
Yeah, it's quite a club, you know, to belong to. Do you remember your first impression?
Let's back up. I applied to her because of what she had done before she was nominated to the D.C. Circuit. She was the architect of a litigation campaign that resulted in a series of landmark Supreme Court rulings prohibiting gender discrimination.
Well, let's remind people. Take us through some of those seemingly ridiculous now early laws. For instance, in 1873, Illinois was allowed to ban women from becoming lawyers because they were too fragile and also because the creator deemed that their paramount destiny and mission was to fulfill the noble and benign offices of wife and mother. This was the law. Then you go to 1908, an Oregon law limited the number of hours that women could work, not men, women, and it relied on Louis Brandeis, a familiar name, to support this notion that women needed protection to avoid harming their reproductive function.
Right. One thing we should say about Brandeis, he made this argument in part, I think, because of other Supreme Court decisions that said that states generally could not limit the working hours of anybody. Brandeis was outraged by those decisions, and in some ways, he was looking for a way to chip away at those rulings. But in doing so, he made an argument that bought into the stereotype that women were too fragile to get out in the real world and work. And that meant that women had many fewer opportunities than men did.
Right. Well, it's in this kind of pool that she dives. And you write, she starts with a case, Reed versus Reed. It challenged an Idaho law that required probate courts to appoint men to administer estates, even if there was a qualified woman. And it was the case of a couple named Reed, long divorced, very sad to me. Their teenage son had committed suicide. Both the parents wanted to administer his tiny little estate, and the judge appointed the father because that was required by state law. And this got appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. She didn't, Ginsburg didn't argue this case, but wrote the brief. I mean, that there it is right there. That is not equal under the law.
That's right. Reed, in one sense, is a small case, but then Professor Ginsburg understood that this kind of small-looking case could be the opportunity to make some good law. And in fact, that's what happened. The court said that this kind of gender-based law was unconstitutional. The court had never, ever found any gender-based law to be unconstitutional in its entire history. That was a breakthrough.
Talk a little bit about how early on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and this, you know, others have mentioned this, but she understood that when she was fighting gender discrimination, that fight included men as well. So there were widowers who were challenging the Social Security Act provision that gave benefits only to widows who automatically received survivors' benefits, not to widowers.
That's right. And Justice Ginsburg understood that laws that restricted women's opportunities also affected men. Now, she understood this just at a very basic level, in part because she had a wonderfully supportive husband, Martin Ginsburg.
Marty.
They met in college, and Marty was her biggest booster for his entire life. But she also was a very good lawyer, a brilliant lawyer. She knew that when she was going to the Supreme Court, she knew that she was talking to a group of 9 middle-aged and older men. And so she thought, I need to persuade these folks that I've got a serious legal argument. What better way to do that than by showing them that assumptions about what was a male function and what was a female function might influence them as well.
Well, and you were there for Ruth Bader Ginsburg's first appearance before the Supreme Court as a lawyer, and she was appearing on behalf of Air Force Lieutenant Sharon Frontiero, who was required by law to prove that her husband was dependent on her for at least half his support in order for her to get housing, medical and dental benefits. A male person in the military did not have to do that. You talked to her about that. What?
Right.
Just give us one thing that she told you that was eye-opening for you.
The most significant thing she said was she had never argued at the Supreme Court. She had done a few arguments in lower courts. She was really nervous. But when she got to the lectern and began the argument, she said she felt a jolt of energy. And she got 4 justices to say that the court should use the same legal standard for evaluating gender-based classifications as it did for evaluating race-based classifications, which is to say they're almost always invalid. But for several of the justices, the analogy to racial discrimination was a step too far. She took these cases incrementally to try to expand on the legal doctrine that she was trying to get the court to endorse.
Jonathan Enten, you go on to be a clerk for her now when she's an appeals court judge. Give us one thing that has made you different because of having done that.
I can't think of one thing that's different. There's so many things that are different. I would not be the person I am. I would not have had the career that I've had without having been part of Justice Ginsburg's judicial family. I do not have words to say how important that has been to me. But I also want to say one other thing about Justice Ginsburg. If she had never been on the Supreme Court, she would have been a person of enormous historic significance, precisely because of the things that you and I have been talking about in this conversation. But these days, that's not how you get on the Supreme Court. You get on the Supreme Court by being perceived by whichever party as being right on the issues that matter. And it doesn't give you the opportunity to do other things. So the loss of Justice Ginsburg is not just the loss of a jurist of historic stature, as Chief Justice Roberts has put it. In a way, we've seen the last of an era in the kinds of people who wind up on the Supreme Court. And I think that's a loss for the court, and I think it's a loss for the country.
Jonathan Enten, Professor Emeritus of Law and Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. But I think the title he'd really like us to mention today is Once a Clerk for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jonathan, thank you so much for your reflections today.
Thank you.
This election season, we want to hear from you and what you care about. So we're asking public radio reporters from around the country to go out safely and to their neighborhoods to hear what matters to you most ahead of this historic election. We'll start with two hotly contested states, Florida and North Carolina, where both presidential candidates touched down this week, Biden yesterday and President Trump today, in an appeal to undecided voters. WUNC reporter Naomi Prelo went door-to-door in Greensboro, home of the 1960 Woolworth sit-ins, and talked with neighbors on Wood Creek Drive, a tree-lined street in the predominantly Black Woodley neighborhood.
My name is Regina Bell. I am a Black African-American woman. I work in security, worked in law enforcement for 19 years in the state of South Carolina.
Bell is planning to vote by mail. And while she's technically still undecided, she knows who she is not going to be voting for this year.
I haven't truly made up my mind. I know definitely that I'm not voting for Trump. So I know definitely that I'm not voting for him. You definitely got to have a spiritual view in order to be directed in the right way to who to vote for. If you go that way, take it to God and pray about it. And it may not be the number one person, but yet still it may be the person better than the other or the candidate.
Bell's neighbor, Audrey Carter, is a 35-year-old Uber driver. Carter doesn't agree with Bell's idea that one candidate is better than the other. She actually doesn't like any of them.
No, I'm not planning to vote because I feel like this country's going to hell in a handbasket. It doesn't matter who we vote for. It just won't be the same.
Bell says she's tired of the divisions in this country.
I think I would vote independent because I don't trust Biden or Trump. Because I have seen what Biden has said about Black people in the 90s, and I've seen what Trump has done, and I just don't like either one of them.
John Parson lives just a little further down the street. The 58-year-old machinist says he'll be going to the polls in person this year, despite the pandemic, because he doesn't trust vote by mail. But he knows who he's voting for.
Vice President from Obama, Biden. I always forget his name sometimes. Because he can't go wrong when nobody else has already been in there.
All three neighbors say they're tired of living with the daily restrictions of the pandemic. And they're also weary of the deep division splitting the country. Here's Regina Bell again.
It will always be racism. That will never end. But you have to get to the place where you know how to cope with it and know how to go around it and still be who you are and stand tall in what you are and what you believe.
The fight for racial justice is also a big issue for voters in Florida, like Kevin Murray, who's Black.
I don't like what's going on in the United States right now with this Antifa and Black Lives Matter garbage that's going on. I hate that because what it's doing is it's separating us instead of uniting us.
WLRN reporter Amber Amortegui met Kevin and his wife, Janine Murray, while they were walking along the many shops and restaurants on Clematis Street, known by local college students for its vibrant nightlife in downtown West Palm Beach, Florida. A state that often plays a pivotal role in presidential elections. And once again, this year, the margins are razor thin. Amber chose this area because she says it demonstrates how polarized the state is, with a mix of rich and working class folks who have a variety of perspectives, Let's hear more from Kevin and Janine Murray.
I'm voting for somebody that is against killing babies. Yeah, I'm voting for Trump. If y'all want to know that, I'm voting for Trump.
Also, I'm also voting for Trump as a black female. And under his leadership, then we'll have God and everything. And again, abortions.
We're pro-police. Babies, pro-police, pro-Jesus.
Yes.
To the max.
For Logan Freetag, the race is about a different issue. He's an audio engineer, and he's been furloughed for much of the pandemic.
It's just hard to find work in my field right now. The entire production industry is kind of shut down until large groups are comfortable gathering again and it's safe again to have concerts and whatnot. So it's been really tough. Unemployment in Florida has been a mess to deal with. It's been kind of a disaster.
Freetag says he plans to vote by mail because it worked for him in the primaries.
I'm planning to vote for Joe Biden. It's a decision I don't make lightly. I was not a fan of his for a long time. I supported other people in the Democratic race, and I'm hardly a Democrat myself, but that's just who I think is a better alternative at this point and someone that can return us to a more normal state.
Those are voters from West Palm Beach, Florida, and Greensboro, North Carolina. And next week, we'll visit another key state, Wisconsin. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR, in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.